God giving Job a lesson in, or raising the questions about science. However, there was history in that. Because he said, where were you, Job, when I laid the foundations of the earth? Were you there when I did this? Were you there? And Job had to say, no, I wasn't. Tonight's topic is a very interesting topic to me. Lessons from Russian Mennonite history. But it's a challenging thing to do. Now, you understand tonight, I don't know how long you normally have a service on a Sunday night, but I expect a message of about 40 minutes is about normal. Russian Mennonite history spans from 1530 to 1945 and beyond, but particularly I think what's in focus is that period of time. That's 400 years boiled down to 40 minutes. That's pretty tough to do. And but history is an enjoyable thing. Tonight, I don't have many scriptures to refer to. I just like to remind us that history was important to the God of the Old Testament, who's the God of today. And one of the values of the Old Testament is to help us to see how God thinks about things. While many things have changed in the New Covenant, yet we understand how God thinks about things by looking at the Old Testament. And God valued the stories of his faithfulness and his working among men handed down, thank you, to the generations that would follow. In fact, he told them when they crossed the Jordan, he said, now you take out 12 stones and put them there, make an altar, because I want your children to be curious and I want those stones to force you to talk about history. I think he knew something about our tendency to not like history. And he said, I want some things there that bug the little children and they'll ask questions and then you'll say, oh yeah, that's right. I'm forgetting. We did cross the Jordan River and we're supposed to tell you about that. I didn't used to like history when I was young. I don't know if it's a sign of aging or what, but I enjoy history much more today. Now, before we go into Russian Mennonite history, I'd like to just say a few things about history itself. It's been said that history is the laboratory of human experience. I like that. In a laboratory, you take things apart. If you go to Martin's Water Conditioning, you go into their laboratory, and there they analyze water, and they look at it. There's ways of testing it. What is there that should be there? What is there that should not be there? And how can you deal with this? History is a laboratory of human experience. So you can take human experience, and you can look at it. That's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to analyze it, see a little bit what happened, and learn some things from it. You can test it and evaluate it and learn. It's been said that history is our only extensive evidential base for contemplation and analysis of how societies function. That's a mouthful. It's our only base of evidence, place that you can look to for facts about how people work. So you look at history and you can see what makes people tick, what forces influence people and how people respond to them. And it's amazing to me how that things that Russian Mennonites did and ways they responded to pressures, so much identical to what Mennonites today do to those similar pressures, how we respond to them. Now, one of the things about the study of history, it's fairly safe to talk about what the Russian Mennonites did in 1500, 1600, 1700, 1800. That's fairly safe. You don't get in trouble. In fact, I go one step farther. At one point, we'll talk just a little bit about the Flemish-Frisian division in Holland that affected Russian Mennonites. It's safe to talk about what they did and what they squabbled over. You won't get in trouble. In fact, you can make some fairly straightforward statements that you can connect dots down to today and struggles that we face and divisions that we face. You don't even have to say anything about today's. You can talk about the history of what they did, and we can smile and say, that's kind of like us. But I won't get in trouble for talking about the Frisians and the Flemish, their issues. I might get in trouble to talk about issues too straightforward what we face today. So history is somewhat of a safe laboratory to evaluate how people work and to learn lessons from. That's why it's an all right thing to do a message like this on a Sunday night. Lessons from Russian Mennonite history, because we can learn some things for our day today maybe a little easier. Now, tonight's format, I'd like to just take an overview of the timeline of events that happened, and then we'd like to go back and talk about some specific events and some lessons. And I don't want to bore you with lots of dates, and I know some people get a little weary in history subjects. I'd like to keep it simple enough and light enough that we can understand. And I'd like to use the whiteboard a little bit tonight. I see somebody likes to connect their markers like my students at school did. And I'd like to start by doing this. When we talk about the Swiss Reformation, we talk about the Swiss Reformation and the persecution that came upon them. Many of the Swiss brethren, as they left their lands, headed to America. Not all of them, but a lot of Swiss Anabaptists found their way to America. The Dutch Reformation maybe started just a little later. Those people headed north into Prussia and later to Russia. That's not totally conclusive. There's some variation to that. Obviously, when persecution happens, and we don't understand this, but when persecution happens, you do what you have to do to live and survive. And you go where you have to go. And you scoot around the countryside, and so you can't just easily put it all in this box. But that's a little bit of an overview of what happened. Now, Reformation, I'll put a few dates on the board here. 1517 is Martin Luther. That's, I guess, considered the beginning of the Reformation. That's the date when Martin Luther stepped out of the Catholic Church, nailed his 95 theses on the door, told the Catholic Church what he believes, where he believes they're wrong, and began this whole concept of questioning the Catholic authority and looking at the Word and finding what it meant and following it. And Martin Luther and some of those men, while they led in the Reformation, they didn't go all the way with. Martin Luther believed a lot of things, right? But he wasn't willing to stand on it when it was going to cost him his neck. And so from that 1517 as a beginning, you have the Swiss Reformation and the Dutch. Men of Simons would have been from the Netherlands. As persecution ramped up, persecution in Switzerland was from about 1500 to 1700. The Dutch persecution ended somewhat sooner, maybe around 1600. But where the story of the Russian Mennonites starts is about 1530. 1530 to 1540 is when the Dutch began to head to Prussia. Prussia is the land, and I would have liked to bring a huge map along here tonight, but I didn't get that all pulled together. But if you look at Europe, you look at the Netherlands up along the sea, and you go north and east, takes you up through Germany, up into the lands which would now be Poland. Prussia was basically Poland territory. They went up along the sea, the ocean. There's a city up there called Danzig, where it was a very low city. There was a lot of land that could be reclaimed from the sea. And these Mennonites had done it successfully in Holland. And as they fled persecution in Flanders, fierce persecution in Holland, they went north. Basically, what was happening was some of those northern cities and countries had not decided that they would drive out the Anabaptists. They hadn't decided that they were okay, but they just... The Anabaptists snuck into those areas, and there they lived. And all of these nations were afraid of being in trouble with the Catholic Church. So many of these nations that left room, cities that left room, and areas that left room for the Anabaptists, they just did it kind of quietly, wondering what the Catholic Church will say about it and what kind of trouble they'll get into. So the Mennonites went north there. They found reception in Prussia. Actually, the Prussia liked what they did. They saw these were successful farmers. They made space for them. These Mennonites reclaimed land from the sea. They built up the land. The country said, this is good. This is a good thing. The Mennonites prospered in Prussia to some degree from 1540 to 1788. 1540 to 1788. That's 200 years in Prussia. Fairly successful. By the time, by 1789, it said that the Mennonites owned 80,000 acres in Prussia. Huge farms, taking back land from the sea, very, very prosperous. but these were foreigners. They had moved in. And community people looked at foreigners a little strange. And so there was always this jealousy about these prosperous Mennonites. It was continually under the surface. And so they faced some of that. Even though they were prospering in Prussia, they had freedom to a point. But one of the big struggles that they always struggled with, just about anywhere they went, was military exemption. In Prussia, for a while they were exempt, and then they had to pay a military tax. They had to pay a tax to be exempt. And that tax kept going up until it was ridiculously high. But because the king saw these people are prosperous, they have money, and you need several things to run a war, an army. You need money and you need men. If you can't get men out of these people, you might be able to get money out of them. And that's what he did. And so the Mennonites, well, they struggled with this question of can you pay a tax so you don't have to go off to war? But they had decided that they could pay the tax, they couldn't go to war. And so here in Prussia, they picked up a German dialect. We must remember these people came from Dutch, from the Netherlands. And they picked up, by the time they get to Russia, Russia looks at them as Germans, not Dutch. And we'll see what the Mennonites, and at one point, went back and worked hard to prove their Dutch roots. Not German roots, but Dutch roots, to get away from the stigma against the Germans. But here, they, you know, as time is 200 years, they basically became German in their appreciations and their way of life. They picked up the German culture. Because actually in Russia, in World War I, when the Germans came in through, many Mennonites were glad for the German army to come. Many Mennonites identified with German values. In fact, I read one book about in Germany that many Mennonites in Germany were really glad for the rise of Hitler. And some German Mennonite churches, German Anabaptist churches, sent letters saying, "We will help you because Hitler rose to help the poor and the suppressed." And some Mennonites said, "We will be at Hitler's assistance." Well, they realized it went astray eventually, and they embarrassed for their identity with Hitler. So they had this 200 years of prosperous prosperity. But by 1789, actually 1789, you know what that year is in American history? 1789. Okay, War of Independence was over. I think 1789, George Washington was inaugurated president. 1789, Frederick William II came to power. He's ready to fix the country's problems. You got this ethnic group of people who owns this big chunk of land who won't give men for the war efforts. And we got some animosity toward them. And so now it's time to fix some of these problems. And so he starts to squeeze his thumb on them, be it in taxes. Military exemption was getting harder. By 1860, in Prussia, it was mandatory to serve in the military. There's no exemption, no paying a tax, nothing. Every young man, and I'm not exactly sure how they did that, but it was mandatory military service by 1860. And so, but here's what happened. By this time, this 200 years in Prussia, something happened in the Mennonite church. They owned 80,000 acres of land, but not everybody owned land. Because as Prussia got a little concerned about these people, these countries, Prussia and Russia, both struggled with this problem. They liked these Mennonites, but they were almost too prosperous. They liked them there, but how can we contain them? So they got to the point where they said, you can't buy land from anybody other than a Mennonite. In other words, land must stay within Mennonites. A Mennonite can't buy a regular Prussian's land because taking up too much land. A little like Pharaoh trying to keep the children of Israel tight. And so land became a problem, and there became this inequality in the church. You had the rich people who had land, and you had the rising generation not able to buy land. And then at one point in Russia, they forbid them to divide farms. Said, and I don't think this was true in Prussia, but they said, you can't subdivide just what you got. So you can't subdivide, and you can't buy land from your neighbors. Well, that makes a hardship. What are you going to do? So you have, and another problem that they had in the church, and we'll talk about this in some of the lessons, they wouldn't ordain a man who didn't own land. A qualification, they looked more at a successful businessman than character of life. So all the preachers owned land. All the bishops, they were big operators. And you have this whole group of people that are landless, and this government is cranking down on them, and they're going to need to flee. And then the government says, oh, wait, we don't want them to all leave, so we'll make it hard to sell land. Guess who can leave quickly? The landless people. But there's no leaders with that group. So a bunch of people left, headed, well, they send delegations into Russia. The Catherine the Great send an invitation over to these Prussians, come. I got some land. I got some vast grassland in this country that ought to be farmed. I saw how prosperous you were. I saw what you did with farms in Prussia. Come over here. I got land for you. That was 1763 was the first invitation from Russia. But the Mennonites didn't move too quickly. They sent a delegation over. Actually, Catherine sent a German-speaking man over to befriend these German Mennonites and to really assure them that this is safe to come to Russia. That we understand German values and there's place for you over here. It took, 10 years until they really took up the offer and headed to Russia. So that brings us up to the beginning of the colonies. I would say that from 1789 to 1870. Is colonization in Russia. Colonization in Russia. And there's a number of colonies that got started. Kortytsa, Malachna, Tracht, and Alexandertal. The Russians, Catherine the Great, offered them land. I think they were offered 162 acres per family. Now, you have to understand, 162 acres in 1780s and 1800s is a lot of land. That's a huge chunk of land. It's more than one family can farm without a tractor. And so that's an exorbitant present per family. You can come and you can have this. You can have this land. You can have this land and you can farm it. She offered them that they could rule their own colonies. One of the things that she was concerned about, though, is she's concerned that they would not proselyte the Orthodox church that was there. They were allowed to invite poor peasants, poor ungodly people to their church, but they weren't allowed to invite other Christians. In fact, it eventually came frowned upon to do any kind of evangelism. So as they went over there and they've got these huge tracts of land, they set up their colonies. They're not really supposed to be out reaching out to others. So they set up their own thing. They ruled their own people. And that brought some of its own challenges, and we'll talk about some of them later. But they could have their own schools. They could have freedom of speech. They could have freedom from the military. They could run their own affairs. They could do whatever they wanted. Their colony was theirs. In fact, they were tax-free, I believe, for 10 years coming into the country. So you give a family 162 acres... You let them do whatever they want with that acres and you don't tax them for 10 years? You know what that equals? Prosperity. Prosperity. And they prospered. Those colonies grew. Catherine the Great died in 1796. The lady that invited them in, 1796, she passed away. Her son, Paul, I believe it was, took power. He was murdered in 1801. He had promised that he would keep Catherine's word to them. The Mennonites were always a little concerned as leadership changed, would the promise be kept from the authorities? And that was one of the issues that changed. That's one of the things that got the Mennonites in trouble. in this country. Just for a little backing away from this, to think about what's happening during this colonization period. If you studied world history, the Wars of Napoleon happened in the early 1800s. 1812, I believe, was the year that Napoleon burned down Moscow. So the Mennonites faced some difficulty during the Napoleon Wars, but they were fairly tight communities, fairly closed communities, and they kind of looked out for each other. Eventually, by World War II, they were ready to fight to protect themselves. And that also brought its own problem. But in this period of time, 1814, there's a group left from this group of Russian Mennonites, started what's known as the Kleine Gemeinde. You find some of those descendants of those people in some colonies in Paraguay and maybe even in Canada. 1860, the Mennonite Brethren pulled out of these Russian, because these Russian colonies became very much traditional, very steeped in making money and farming, and spiritual life was ebbing. And revival fires came through the Lutheran Church, came through some of the other ones. And you hear this, you hear people talk about pietism. There's this fire of pietism that burned through some of those areas. And basically the bad side of pietism was the teaching that it's Christianity is only in your heart and nowhere else. There's a good side of pietism that says that we love God with all our heart, and that's the most important thing. And it will work itself out in how we live. And so we have to be careful when we knock pietism, because pietism actually found place in those old colonies because they were dead formalists. And they needed some revival, but then some of that went too far and put away Bible teachings. Krimmer Mennonite Brethren pulled out in this period of time, and so they knew some divisions. They knew some splits and splendors. But by 1870, Russia began saying, wait a minute, this scares us. And if you were to look at a map, many of the Mennonite settlements were on the western edge of Russia, closer to Germany. Russia has always feared and hated Germany, and Germany has always feared and hated Russia. Those two were huge powers, Germany being one of the main powers involved in World War I, and Germany being the main power involved in World War II. A lot of those wars, Germany led the way in those things, and Russia had to protect herself. And Russia starts looking at this thing and saying, wait a second, we got this huge group of Germans on our western edge close to Germany. Is that really a good thing? What are they, traitors? What would happen if Germany wanted this profitable land and these Germans would welcome the German army? We could have a problem. And so Russia got a little concerned about these ethnic groups, these Germans. Remember, they were now known as Germans, not as Dutch. And because of this, Russia somewhat fearing Germany and wanting to keep Germany over, don't take any of our lands, they started looking at these colonies. 1870, they started this effort called Russianization Law. And basically what it meant was that all people living in Russia must fit into Russian culture. And that involved Russia taking over their schools. Couldn't have these ethnic schools. We got to have some control in these groups. Now, they did give the Mennonites 10 years to comply, but after 10 years, everyone was a regular Russian. No special provisions for any ethnic group. Well, suddenly the question of military exemption comes up. Is that going to be for us? Here's all these Mennonites. We were promised this military exemption. Now the Russian leaders are saying we need everybody to be like equal Russians. No special favors for anybody. Where is that going to leave the Mennonites? 1874, that became law. And that year, 1874, 1875, about 18,000 Russians left Russia for America, Canada,
I hate to spell in front of people
when I'm trying to talk. More were prepared to leave, but Rushy gets a little alarmed. Rushy doesn't want to see these successful farmers leaving. Russia by now, these Mennonite colonies by now, had already gotten themselves back to the place where they were in Prussia, where they had wealthy landowners and poor landless people. And they kept starting new colonies to try to deal with this and try to help people to have land, but there was becoming inequalities in the church. We'll talk about that in some of the lessons for us to think about. And so some of these Mennonites pulled out, but some stayed. Russia saw this and said, hey, wait, okay. We'll make military exemption for you all. We want you to stay here on our land. And so they did. And many, many Russian Mennonites stayed. They should have left. Looking back now, when you look at what happened to the Russian Mennonites, they should have all bailed out of that country. They had a period of 1880 to 1914. It's called the Golden Age of the Russian Mennonites. Their colonies prospered. This is what happened when these 18,000 pulled out. They were some of the concerned people. They were some of the movers and shakers. And they left. And what was left in Russia, they adopted this view. See if I have it written down here. Maybe I didn't write that down. But they adopted this view of just becoming like the people around them. And they said that in non-essentials, unity. Oh, I forget. In everything, charity. In non-essentials, unity. And in essentials, I forget. There's three things. But basically, they said, look, in non-essentials, we're just going to, anything is fine. Just a few basic Bible doctrines that we'll hold to, and all these non-essentials that the church held to. We can have Russian people involved in our school. Earlier, they were concerned about maintaining their German language. Now they're ready to have Russian language. They're ready to blend in with the culture. I think at this period of time, they were allowed to have German for their Bible class at school, but everything else had to be in Russian, because this is that push. Get them into the Russian way of life. And because they cooperated with it, Russia was okay with them, gave them military exemption. In fact, some of these Mennonites who stayed and went through this golden age looked with disfavor at the 18,000 who left. And they said, it's wrong to leave. We're to be a salt in the earth. God wants us here in our country. And many of them said that, well, now the reason we have peace is because the restless people left. And now this is God's blessing upon us. It was a quiet before the storm. Well, 1914 brought World War I. And as Germany headed over through into Russia, guess what happens? German Mennonites value German. They identify with some of the Germans, and the Russians see that. One of the things that was going on in this golden age as they were building their colonies and they were building their farms, Russian Mennonites were getting richer and richer, and the poor peasants that worked for them were not paid maybe what they should have been, and they got angry about it. The poor peasants living there were jealous. Look at these rich Mennonites. Some of them even worked for them. Later we'll talk about a story of a young man that worked for a Mennonite and was very bitter toward them and actually led armies against them. And so the Russian people are watching as these Mennonites identify with Germans. Brought some problems for them. But the worst would come in 1917. 1917 was the Bolshevik Revolution. Bolshevik Revolution. Basically, what was happening in Russia was the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer, even outside of the Mennonites. And there's a huge difference in class of people, and the poor people were getting tired of it. And basically, in my opinion, what communism did in Europe was offered the poor man a place to get a hold in life. And that's why people joined in with Hitler. That's why people joined in with Lenin, because there was an offer of being able to make out better. Bolshevik Revolution led by Lenin. was basically following communist values. And from 1918 to 1921 was the civil war in Russia, where the Bolsheviks, the Red Army under Lenin, the communists were trying to take over the country. The White Army was the existing rulers. They were very disunified, but the existing Russian government trying to hold on. So you have the Red Army against the White Army, and there's this battle going on. And I don't think we understand what happens in a country where there's a revolution that takes place like this. From 1918 to 1921, 13% of the population of Russia was killed in that civil war. That's 20 million people dead. Do you know what 20 million people looks like? I think New York City is 6 million. 6 million people. So you'd have to wipe out 3 New York cities. Lots of people died. 13% of the population wiped out. Bolsheviks systematically destroyed Russian Mennonite life. The Bolsheviks hated family life. They hated religion. They taught the people that religion is the reason why there's a rich and there's a poor. And they blamed all of the country's woes on religion, not just Mennonites, but Lutherans and all religions. The communists in many countries did the same thing. They turned the attention of people toward the religious people and said, there's all the problems. And went after them and destroyed them. Just horrible treatment. By 1920, the Bolsheviks had pretty much won the war. The White Army was pretty much dissolved. And there was horrible treatment of the Mennonites. There's stories of areas where the soldiers came in, the men were killed, and the women and young girls were molested, and just horrible things took place because they didn't care. And they just destroyed anything that of value that was there. Lenin took control, and from 1921 to 1928, he redistributed the land. It was called the New Economic Policy. So he took land back, and he said, we're going to give land to all the people. And then 1929 to 1933, he started what was called the five-year plan. That was the collectivization of the farms. He said, well, you know what we got to do? The government owns the land, and you people are going to work on it. And so we'll decide who all works on this farm. And it was the setting up of the communist system of a state-owned farm with people running the farm for him. He moved a lot of the people into cities. Most communist countries did that. They moved people into the cities, and they would go out to work on the farms that were owned by the state, and the state would decide what you get paid, how well you get taken care of. You were in their hands because you didn't own a thing. 1934 to 1935, the Communist Party underwent a tremendous purge. It's called the Great Purge. 10% of the Communist Party was eliminated. That was about 7 to 14 million people. They don't know for sure how many people. But anybody in places of authority that had raised questions about what the communists were doing were wiped out. It sent a reign of terror. You didn't question what was being done. You did what you were told to do. You kept your mouth shut. It was not safe to talk. It was not safe. You just did what you were told to do and shut up, because death reigned if you went against them. 1937 to 1938, the last Mennonite leaders were shipped into exile. Many of the leaders of the church were captured, sent east into Siberia, into exile, to suppress this group of people that they don't have leaders to be able to lead them out of the country. Many men lost their lives. In fact, August 28, 1941, the decree came to remove all Germans to Asiatic Russia, the eastern side of Russia, Siberia and east. That decree was made on August 28, and by September 2, they were loading the trains, and all the men had to leave now. They had that many days to get ready to vacate the whole place. 25 Malachna villages were emptied out in the process of a week of all the men that were there. Half of the men lost their lives on that trip. Some of them commit suicide. They were to the point whereby it was hard for them to see any kind of future, because the government, the bloodshed, the terror that reigned, You were in the hands of terrible men, and you were probably going to die. And many, many Mennonite men, sad to say, took their lives in that period of time. World War II, 1943, brought the Germans back into Russia. Actually, when they retreated on their way out, they took some Mennonites with them. German Mennonites identified with them. But by that point in time, many of the once prosperous colonies were emptied out. 1945, the original mother colonies from Danzig and Prussia area, those colonies that were suppressed and where people left to go into Russia in 1945, the end of World War II, Germany, Hitler and his armies pretty much wiped out many of those people who wanted to maintain their identities, wiped out those colonies. 1943, 44, somewhere in there is where MCC, Mennonite Central Committee, was formed to help Russian send relief to Russia. One of the horrible things that happened is families got split up. And forget what the name of the book is that follows some of those stories of men hauled off to the east and ladies' families left behind, never knowing where their loved ones got to, their family got to, and took many, many years. Some of them escaping to America, not knowing if their loved ones alive, and many years later in America finding each other because of being alive and being able to find it. If you read the story in CLP's Perspectives of Life in Literature, the story of Clayton Kratz. Clayton Kratz was one of the delegates of MCC to go to Russia to take relief over and to work with the Russian Mennonites that were just so much in poverty and destroyed. Clayton was captured by, I forget if it was the Red Army, I believe it was. Clayton was captured, never to be found again. It's not known what happened to him. Well, that's the story of, that's just a quick rundown of the years. Now, I'd like to just talk about a couple stories, a couple things, a couple parts of this story that we ought to learn lessons from. One of the things that became a problem in Russia when they were allowed to have their own colony and rule themselves, it looked like a great opportunity, but after they got started, they realized somebody's going to have to keep law and order. And so the subject of non-resistance, and how do you do this? How can you have a colony that rules itself and be a church and a state in one? So they really got tested on this church and state thing. While it seemed right to do for freedom, it had this side to it that they hardly knew what to do with, and they kept going with it until they didn't understand separation of church and state. One of the things that happened, the village assemblies, they held title to the land. The men who decided things in the village, they were men who owned land. They profited from the ag industry. And so decisions in the village and in the church were made based on what kind of money, the economic side of it, more than the spiritual side of it. Church leaders were civil leaders too. Many of these colonies, it said, were bound together more by blood than by faith. Many people stayed in the colony because it made sense economically to be here, and they didn't really believe and embrace this faith that was supposedly part of this colony. And that produces deadness anywhere that you go. American Mennonites today, we can have that same problem. We can have a type of group that is bound together more by blood than by faith. And you have a rising generation that can say, while this doesn't make sense and my heart isn't really in it, I'm going to stay here because it makes sense because I can have grandpa's money to buy a farm and whatever else. There's a lesson in that for us. Well, the second thing, that's the mix-up of church and state and running their own affairs brought some problems. The second issue I already alluded to, when they left Prussia, they left with no church leaders because the leaders were landholders. They should have learned that lesson, but they went to Russia and ended up repeating the same thing, that they'd ordained men that were prosperous, not poor students of the word, but prosperous men. So no leadership went along. So they had this problem. So what are you going to do for preaching? So they elected some laymen to just read the scriptures and read sermons. I was reading this and I'm thinking, we could do this in the Bronx, read sermons and read scriptures because we don't have a preacher to go. But it caused the church some problems because they didn't have leadership along as they took this whole colony of people, as they took these thousands of people and started a colony and then later another colony. So then they had the same problem that we have today, whereby we think that, maybe I should stay with history and not make it practical. But here's what happened. The Prussian church, the elders still back in Prussia, seeing that the Russian group doesn't have leaders, they said, well, give us a list of qualified men. We'll pick some leaders from that. We understand. We have the control here in Prussia over way over there. We haven't even been there to see what's going on. So they picked some leaders to lead the church. And that didn't work very well. I think they should have gone to the field and ordained on the field. But so there was that challenge of leadership being along. And the challenge of the home church feeling the pressure to maybe direct too many of the affairs in that church there in Russia. Well, another thing that was thing that cost them something, another lesson we should learn is in Prussia and in Russia, they had a lot of emphasis on preserving themselves as a people. The German language was part of that. Preserving themselves as a people. There was more emphasis on that maybe than spirituality and understanding God and having God being real to them. There was more emphasis of preserving themselves. The language, the agriculture, and their faith. They wanted to keep those things, preserve them. And so religious life at some point came to the point where it rested more on traditionalism than it did on Bible teaching. And that's part of the reason why whenever pressures came upon them, they made some poor decisions, some unscriptural decisions, because they were more concerned about preserving themselves than about obeying the Word of God. In fact, we'll talk about that at one point. They actually had a military because they were preserving themselves. That was their emphasis more so than simple obedience to the word, even if it costs us not being preserved as a neat little group in our economic situation. Another thing that was part of this that happened as they tried to preserve themselves as a people, they had tight colonies. And the interaction with the peasants was not very good. Some of the colonies had peasants work for them, but they were paid a low wage. The peasants were looked down on. These were the successful Russians. It had a bad for Russian Mennonites. It did something bad to the way they looked at themselves. And it did something bad for them at how they looked at peasants. Tell you what, one of the best things that we need in our conservative Mennonite churches today is people who come into us from various walks of life. So we can think straight about who we are, and we can think straight about who the rest of the world is. We need that. It's one of the lessons that we can learn from them. Now, let's talk a little bit about this Flemish-Frisian division. It was carried along to Russia. It was basically a division that took place in Netherlands. And I believe it was 1550s maybe. I don't have that date written down here. But there was this division between the Flemish and the Frisian. I don't really like to read about church divisions, but it catches my eye wondering, so what were the issues? What were the issues? Well, the Flemish people were weavers. They made cloth. And so they wore fine clothing. And the Frisians looked at them and said, you're worldly because of the clothing you're wearing. The Frisians, they wore simple clothes, but they built fine houses and bought nice furniture. And the Flemish looked at them and said, you're materialistic because you put too much into your houses. That's one of the differences between them. And they struggled. They struggled over that. And let me just read... Let me just read a little piece from this book. This is a book by EMP, the Russian Mennonites. between these two groups. It says that variant practices divided the two groups. And I want you to listen. I want you to listen for the biblical foundation that divided these two groups. I want you to understand the deep doctrinal error between the two groups. Flemish preachers read their sermons while seated. Frisian preachers did not read their sermons. In Flemish congregations, candidates for baptism were confirmed by two character witnesses whose names were read from the pulpit. They baptized by pouring, but the Frisians baptized by sprinkling. In Flemish congregations, the elder distributed the communion emblems to the members who remained seated. In Frisian congregations, the members filed past the elder to receive the emblems. You understand? These are big differences to Flemish and Frisian, but when I read this book, they're little differences. Okay? But it divided them. Numerous attempts to reconcile such differences failed. In fact, some of them resulted in further division. The sharp distinction between Flemish and Frisian congregations continued until the middle of the 1700s. The differences that separated the Mennonites in Prussia were carried along with those who migrated to Russia. One of the things that happened, the Russian people saw Mennonites who didn't get along, and it was part of the stigma as peasants and Russian authorities looked on and said, "Y'all have issues that you can't solve." Well, intermarrying was forbidden. If you married someone from the other group, they'd excommunicate you. Persons transferring from one group to the other one would have to be rebaptized, because if you were over in this group, you weren't good enough, your baptism wasn't valid. Congregations that didn't align with either side were banned by both of them. In other words, you had to declare yourself with the Flemish or the Frisian. If you said, "No, we're with neither of them would fellowship with you." Sounds like North America. And then 1567, dear brother Dirk Phillips gets called in to mediate. And he made a mistake. He saw some things. In his own mind, he felt more in line with the Flemish. And early on in his investigation, he made some statements that lended his weight to the Flemish, and the Frisians picked up on it, and his work was done. The pieces flew because they saw him as being already tipped toward the one side, and his work was done. It actually made more pieces. If you follow that division, eventually, strangely enough, you have Frisians and Flemish, and after a while, you have Flemish Frisians and Frisian Flemish as they tried to redefine themselves. It gets ridiculous, the titles to try to... Now, at some point in time, many of those groups went back together when they got to the point where they said, you know what, the non-essentials don't matter, it doesn't matter in practice. Some of those groups were put back together, but many of their convictions were already lost by that time. Another lesson, another thing that we ought to talk about is the Mennonite colonies and the inequalities that it produced in Prussia and in Russia. We already referred to this. But the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. There was landless poor Mennonites. In fact, in Russia, it got to the point where Russian Mennonite landless people went to the Russian government to petition them to work on this so that they can have an equal position with their other Mennonite people. The other Mennonites in the colony. And through some of those efforts, they were granted some more land, some places they could start some more colonies. But poor Russian Mennonites went to the civil authorities for help to have a place and consideration in Mennonite colonies. Reminds me of what Paul said about the Corinthians. Don't you have men wise enough to solve your problems? Why do you go to law before unbelievers? And so... But one of the things that happened is church leaders were landowners, they were wealthy, and so the poor people seldom got a hearing in the church and in the civil side of the Russian Mennonite colony, because the leaders held the land, and they kind of looked down on the poor people that didn't have land. They took care of themselves, and you had this gross inequality. I think it was 1860. Was the first petition. 1863, the Russian government stepped in, made a couple laws about how this shall be. By the time that that by the time that Russia began squeezing down on the Mennonites, when the Mennonites said, wait, remember your promise to us, Russia returned and said, we have volumes in the courthouse of us having to step in to solve your land problems. Don't tell us you're such a different people, because we have volumes of information about the problems in your own colonies. And so you're going to come under Russian law just like everybody else. You're going to be a normal Russian because that's what you are. You have the same problems in your colonies that we have among other in the nation. And so that did not speak well for them. They did not take care. I think it was 1865, I found some statistics that in the Malachna colony, there was 2,356 families that were landless, not owning land, while 1,300 families owned land. 1,300 families with land, 2,356 without land. All right, let's talk a little bit about, oh, here's where I have this written. After the 1870s emigration, after the these people left, after these restless people left, and they had this golden years, was it 40 years of prosperity, they had this emphasis on cultural adaptation, and this is what they said: unity in the essentials, tolerance in the non-essentials, and charity in all things. That became their motto, to blend all things together and actually blend in with Russian society somewhat. There was a booming ag industry, Turkey red wheat. If you read about that being brought to America, that came out of this period of time. It was wheat that was raised in Russia that did well, and they brought it to America. Farming implements, there's actually Mennonite factories that rolled out, I forget, it was like 10% of the Russian farm equipment was made by Mennonite manufacturers. They really had an edge on the ag industry. It was capitalism at its height, headed straight into communism. They didn't realize it. Headed for a clash. They had mutual aid plans. They had rest homes. They had schools. They had hospitals. They had orphanages. They had the whole spectrum of caring for their communities. Now you say, well, how does that work? You just told us that there was poor people and people without land. It's one of those situations whereby the rich got richer, and yes, they did some of these facilities, but they were like organized facilities. There wasn't anything in place, there was little in place to help the young families get started on land and get established. They kind of ignored that side of it and just figured that people should be able to take care of themselves. And not in these big estates. Part of the problem was Russia at some point wouldn't let them subdivide because they were concerned about these Mennonites and their growth. They wanted to try to stop some of that. All the while this was going on, they're taking advantage of poor peasants. And that brings us to the story of the man Nestor Machno, Machno. In this period of time, 1918. During the Bolshevik Revolution, Machno led an army of 100,000 soldiers. Machno was a rebel. At first, he was not part of the White Army or the Red Army. His 100,000 soldiers were bandits from the poor peasants who were tired of being poor and who wanted something better for their life. And they realized they weren't going to get it from the Russian government. They weren't going to get it from the Mennonites. They were going to have to go get it themselves. And so he led this band of people. Now he had worked. He had herded cattle for the Mennonites. And they took advantage of him. And he had a hatred in his heart for Mennonites. And he knew they took advantage of him. He knew some of those business dealings. And he carried this bitterness. And when he had 100,000 soldiers with him, he went and made havoc in the Mennonite communities. When the German army retreated at one point, they gave arms, they gave firearms to the Mennonites, said, you need to protect yourself against bandits. This country is in civil war. You're going to have to protect yourselves because the Russian government won't protect you. And so the Mennonite young people had already been inspired by German militarism, because they were German. They had a German bone in them. They liked the Germans. And German soldiers were well-dressed. They were high-class people. And these prosperous Mennonites, some of their young people, wanted to be at the top of society, also in the army. And so they organized a Mennonite army called Selbstutz, or Selbstutz. Not Dutch enough to be able to say those words. But it was basically Mennonite young people in this armed force. But they had decided from the start they would not fight the Red Army. Basically, they organized themselves just to protect their colonies. They were not out to overthrow the Red Army. They were not out to necessarily help the White Army. But they identified more with the White Army values. That was the army that was endeavoring to keep Russia the same. And the Reds were the Bolsheviks who were trying to overthrow and do away with what was there and bring more equality. So, but Machno leads these men around. These Mennonite soldiers get pretty good in their army. And then, and they resist. They're able to hold off Machno from their colonies. But Machno's strength is growing and growing, and this group of Mennonite soldiers is realizing they're soon going to be whipped by Machno. And so they joined with the White Army. The White Army came through the area, and they said, look, we'll help you. Help us protect our colonies. So they joined the White Army. Soon after that, Machno joined the Red Army, much, much bigger army than the White Army. Then the Mennonite young boys got scared because they had decided they're not fighting the Red Army. But they had already fought Machno. They had already joined hands with the White Army, and then they said, whoa, wait, we want out of it. We're a non-resistant people. And it didn't work. The Red Army hated them, and you know what? The White Army hated them because they deserted the White Army, and they had joined the White Army, which put them in opposition to the Red Army. Machno was there, and it cost them severely. Colonies who did not have young boys that joined that made out better than colonies who fought and had young men in that. It was really to their destruction. It's not a right concept from Scripture to do. So scripturally, it's wrong. But even from a tactical and practical standpoint, it was a wrong move. Cost them tremendous. There's tremendous bloodshed. And what happened in those Civil War years, the White Army would push forward, push the Red Army back. And so then the White Army would be protecting the Mennonite civilization. And then the Red Army would shove them back, so fighting would happen right over the Mennonite territory, and soon Mennonites found themselves behind the Red Army lines, and then the White Army would push back, and they're behind White Army lines, and back and forth. And every time they cross those lands, guess what? They take horses. They plunder the fields. I'm told today, if you visit these areas in Russia, you will find very few large Mennonite homes and barns, farm evidences of their farms. It's mostly Russian-built homes, because a lot of it was destroyed in that civil war. You can't hardly go and find it. You go to Switzerland, you can find some of those Mennonite dwellings. You go to Russia, and you can't find much of it because of that destruction. And so, there's a lesson about non-resistance. There's a lesson about, well, being friends. See, the Bible in Luke 16:9 says, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. And I think what that means is use our means to make friends with people around us, even people who won't come to church with us. Use our means to bless them. I don't know if it ever goes against you when you do that. Can you think of a time when you used your means to bless somebody in a community and it really blew up in your face or went against you? Sometimes people take advantage of us, I know that. But it's not because we were kind to them, it's because of their evil heart. And so Jesus taught us to be servants. So another one of the lessons that I'd like us to think about tonight is, let's not put too high a value on prosperity. It's one of the downfalls of the Russian Mennonite church. And I don't know what would happen in America if civil war would break out. And I, you know, as you watch, and I'm not here to paint a dark picture about American history, but it's not going uphill, I can tell you that. But you know, when a society has a large group of people who are tired of the way government is working or the way society is working, When you have factions of people and armed factions of people who are ready for change, you're ripe for revolution. And the last number of years, there's been more ammunition sold than there's ever been sold. I don't know what that means. But listen, dear ones, tonight, that's not fear, because God is on our side. That's not fear. I don't want to strike fear in our hearts, going away thinking that, revolution will break out tomorrow. No, I don't want that. But I want us to understand that prosperity is not what we're here for. And if we have to leave our houses and homes, if we have to load up on trains to head out of here in a week, can you say goodbye to your farm, your house, your dishwasher, and all that? Can you live in the woods and in a tent and on the hillside? And if you meet a brother from another fellowship, can you help each other to safety as brethren? Another thing I think we ought to understand is we understand that times can change rapidly. We don't understand that in America because it's been so peaceful for way too long. But times can change overnight. They did in this story, and they can in America. And I know that there's a tremendous adjustment, a tremendous yanking our heart around that would happen if we would realize that suddenly we don't have what we had all these years. I don't know how we would fare. How many of us would be faithful to the Word of God, to His kingdom, if it cost us all that? Or how many of us would say, well, but wait a second. I mean, we do have to take care of our family, and so we will have to do this or this. I mean, it is right to take care of your family. I mean, if you don't, you're worse than an infidel. So, I mean, come on. We'll have to protect ourselves, and we must do the Word of God. So understand that times can change. Politically, they can change very fast. Wartime brings this whole big question of who do you assist? The Mennonites in Russia found that out when the White Army went through and they picked up White Army soldiers and helped them. Guess what? Red Army soldiers hate you for helping the white. Would you help a soldier that's wounded on your close to your property? Would it matter which army he's part of? One of the things that happens is that people watch. And if you do anything good for either side, you're in trouble. You read the stories of the George Washington and when he had his army at Valley Forge and how the British came to buy things at the market. And if Mennonites sold things to British soldiers, then the American soldiers were unhappy with them. And if they sold to the American soldiers, then the British soldiers were unhappy with them. And you get caught in the crossfires. Well, last of all, let's value Bible obedience and spiritual life. Let's not get sidetracked, but let's value Bible obedience, spiritual life, living for God. That's what's important in life. And I'm concerned about this in our day today, and I'm okay with our lines on technology and those kind of things, but what's happening in our world today we have this thing called information overload. I experience this and you do too. You can have at your fingertips so much stuff. And it can fill our minds with so many things that they're not wrong. There's maybe good creative things. It might be weather, it might be planets, it might be science and all that. But it chokes out something, chokes out time with the Word of God. And I really wonder if as a church we shouldn't consider more ways to actively build the foundation, keep that in place. And we can, it's appropriate to have lines on things we won't do, but to just say no to this and no to that, no to the next thing. How much are we saying, what are you doing with this part of your spiritual life? Where are you with Bible reading and prayer? Where are you with family worship? Where are you with taking time with God? Because maybe it's an effort of Satan's to take us away and have our hearts grow cold before pressures come upon us so that we buckle in those pressures. God help us to be a faithful people. God help us to learn some of the lessons from history and so that we don't have to repeat the same mistakes, but that we can learn and that we can be what God wants us to be in this our day, be a faithful people, that history can record a faithful group of people living for God,
obeying the Bible through whatever pressures they faced. May the Lord help us to that end.
Thank you.